The energy in this room is so fantastic, and I just heard just like so much about this organization, and like it's just like, oh, that's great, and that's great. Oh yeah, that's also great. That's also great. And then when I see like it in living form here, it's like all of it's true. So I almost like in a perfect world, I'd almost like to just sort of like have you guys do all of the talking, really? And I would just sort of sit down. I'm serious about that, because I'm really genuinely interested in like where your heads are at and everything like that. But they say that words that leave the heart enter the heart. So I'm just going to speak from my heart. And if you have any questions along the way, will you please like just raise your hand? Because if anything strikes you, that's the direction that I want to go in. Like I want to go in the direction of what you're actually interested in and thinking about. And then maybe we'll actually leave some time for questions and answers also, because that would be cool. So anyway, where to start? So I'll just tell you a few things about myself, and then maybe we'll talk about some bigger ideas, okay? So I grew up in New York City, and on 79th Street and Broadway, right in the middle of Manhattan there, and that was like crazy. My dad was a psychologist, so, and he actually had his practice inside the house. So that was interesting, because he really encouraged us to interact with the people who came to see him. And that was a very interesting upbringing. And it just gave me like a tremendous like compassion for people, like built this love for people. My dad had this gift. He, like, within minutes of meeting him, you would like be telling him like all of your deepest, darkest secrets. You know, it was amazing. And it was because he genuinely loved people. He would just say hello. And then, by the way, he had a trick, which I realized, like, it took me decades to figure out what was his technique. And you know what it was? He'd ask a question. He'd say, like, how are you? And then people would say, well, I'm okay. And then he wouldn't say anything. He'd just sort of, like, listen, and they go, well, actually, you know something? Something happened at work. And he would just exude love and wouldn't say anything. And they'd go, yeah, you know, I have this issue with this person. And, you know, it probably started with my mother like a long time ago. And you know, before you know it, like within moments, and it was only because he just made room for people and exuded love. And that combination like just like created this like really special atmosphere. So anyway, so that was my dad. That's where I grew up. And then I got my first job writing for television. So I'll tell you how I became a writer, okay? And I didn't grow up religious, by the way. I started keeping Shabbos when I was 24. And grew up in a sort of a proud Jewish home, but we weren't observant. We didn't keep Shabbos or kosher or anything like that. How did I become a writer? I went to Harvard, and at the end of my freshman year, I heard two people talking. And one says to the other, what are you doing for your summer vacation? And the other one says, oh, I'm going to go like trekking in Asia, something like that. And the other person says, oh, I'm going to be doing like this banking internship on Wall Street, right? Like two very high-end, like very prestigious things. And I'm just thinking, I'm not doing anything. You know, what am I going to do? You know? So I called my mom and I said, Mom, like, what am I going to do? And she said, well, you know, remember I told you we lived on 79th and Broadway. She said, well, I could talk to the superintendent and you could be the elevator man. And I was like, make the call. And she calls me right back, you got the job. I was like, yes. And oddly enough, it's because I became an elevator man, and by the way, I kept that job every summer throughout college because I liked it so much. That's how I became a writer. And I'm leaving out one small detail, which is that I sort of decided that I was going to try to use my time on the elevator wisely and just try to read all like great works of literature. And so I was reading all these amazing, amazing books, like all the classic books, or a lot of them. And and this is going to sound corny, but it's true. I'd read, I was a government major, which is like political science, and I was going to go into law. So, you know, this was all new to me. But I'd read sentences, and they'd be so beautiful, I'd have to actually, like, catch my breath. And that's when I had something welling up inside me that, hey, what if I were a writer? You know, what if I tried to do this? And then there was, like, an intersection between that. So how do you get from reading, like, Dostoevsky and things like that to writing jokes for Bart Simpson, right? It seems like there's a great divide there, you know? So that piece of the puzzle happened when I started writing for the Harvard Lampoon, which was the humor magazine there. And I was there at the same time as Conan O'Brien and Greg Daniels. I don't know if you know the name Greg Daniels, but he created shows like The Office and King of the Hill and things like that. So we were all there at the same time. And there was just this kind of wave of like Lampoon people that came out to Los Angeles. So that's how I got my start. And I got a 3-week trial period. That was, and so cut to, let's see, 1994, 1994, 2004, 2014, 38 years later, that 3 weeks turned into 38 years. Isn't that wild? And just because I was like, when my mom said, hey, you could be the elevator man, I was like, yeah. You know, cut to the rest of my life. So, you know, you never know how life works, you know? You never know, like, what's behind, like, an opportunity. You never know. You never know. So with that in mind, maybe I'll just transition for a moment to Hanukkah, okay? Because Hanukkah is really deep. I sort of came to this conclusion the other night that Hanukkah, of all the Jewish holidays, Hanukkah is the most personal. So I'm going to tell you how I get to that thought in a moment. But this is like really it. So how so? So it says in the Talmud, a very famous teaching that probably many of you have heard before. It says that when all of us are in our mother's womb, an angel comes and teaches us the entire Torah. And there's a candle over our head, you know, that provides us light. And then when we're born, we forget it. So we learn the whole Torah and then we forget it. And they say that's even how you get this, like the angel touches you on the mouth. So a lot of people ask the question then, why learn it to begin with, right? If you're just going to forget it. And so does anyone have an answer to that? Like, there's a really famous answer, but there's, by the way, when you hear questions like this in Torah, there's no wrong answers. Like the Or HaChaim, he's one of the greatest rabbis, he has a rule, just to keep in mind. He says, as long as your answer doesn't contradict Jewish law, then it's fine. Whatever you come up with is a good answer. Like if you say, I know why we forget the Torah, because pork is kosher. So that would not be a good answer. That would be an illegitimate answer. But short of that, anything that sort of like comes from your own creativity and it's coming from a good place, that you've got a legit answer there. Go ahead.
I think it's because you need to find out for yourself again rather than just being told.
Wow. So you get it as a gift the first time, and then you have to go out and earn it. Yeah, that's a great answer. Does anyone else have a thought? Dylan, go ahead.
Maybe so it's like when it's always been yours, so it's like when you learn it, it's almost like a familiarity, like it belongs to you.
Right. That, by the way, is the quote-unquote classic answer that I know, which is that you have it in you already so that when you hear it, and it's going to resonate, and you're going to know that there's like a deep truth to it because it feels right when you hear it. Anyone else have an answer?
I'd say similar to that.
Yeah.
When you hear it, it's much easier to remember something than it is to learn something new. So when you're being taught the Torah in your life, it's more like you're remembering something that you already know rather than getting entirely new information and perspective.
Wow. Yeah. That's it. You know, you're reminding me of something, like sort of like a way of putting that thing, just experientially. Have you ever had this experience where you drive someplace and you drive someplace new and you know you're driving and you don't want to get lost, you don't want to miss a turn, and then it takes a certain amount of time, and then when you drive home it seems like so much shorter? Do you know that? Even though it was the exact same distance. Because when you're going to an unknown place the first time, it's so unfamiliar that you're like, you reminded me of that, because it's sort of like since you've already learned it, it's like driving home almost. You know what I mean? Like when you hear it that second time, there's that level of familiarity and it goes down easier. These are all great answers. Does anyone else have an answer? Why would you get taught it to begin with if you're just going to be made to forget it? Well, that's a lot of good answers already. Should anyone else? No? Okay, go ahead.
So it's in your subconscious?
That's interesting. What do you mean by that?
It's like a layer that's deep, and then you unravel it kind of your whole life.
Okay, so now you're reminding me of one of my favorite teachings. Really? Okay, so let's just go in that direction, but remind me to go back to the baby in the womb, because that's really the Hanukkah teaching. But this is also like a Hanukkah teaching, what you're saying. So one time I was driving, I was listening to NPR. This is like a number of years ago. Since COVID, I stopped listening to the news. Like I still like read the news on like headlines and on the internet, but I stopped listening to it. I'm so much happier. I can't even tell you. It's like, I stopped watching TV news like a long time ago, because that's literally ingesting toxins, you know? Because they just show you like horrible footage just because it's visual and everything like that. You feel worse. So I knew that trick, to stop doing that. But even the radio kind of gives that to you. Now, I'm not saying don't be informed. I'm looking at headlines all day long. But anyway, there's something nice about insulating yourself from that energy. But anyway, every once in a while they would have these amazing studies and things like that. So I really liked listening to that station. And they talked about the monarch butterfly. And so this is one of my favorite teachings. Listen to this. So this is real. This is science. And this is a mystery that has baffled scientists for decades. You ready for this? There's this type of butterfly. It's called the monarch butterfly. And there's a population of them in Mexico. And every year, now I'm going to tell you just straight out, and I think you're all going to go, wow, that really wasn't as amazing as he built it up to be. I'm shocked. But then I'm going to explain it further, and then you're going to go, actually, that's really amazing. So prepare to go on a roller coaster ride, okay? From horribly unimpressed to intrigued. So it goes like this. This population of butterflies, every year to this day, starts off in Mexico, and it ends up in Canada. And then it flies back to Mexico. Can we all agree that that was thoroughly unimpressive information? Okay, now let me explain to you why this has baffled scientists for decades, because I'm leaving out key pieces of information here. The monarch butterfly doesn't live very long. Okay? So what that means is every year when this population of butterflies starts off in Mexico, they've never heard of Canada. And they don't know where it is. And they certainly don't know that they're supposed to go there at this particular time. They have no memory of this. Then they start toward Canada. And like I said, they don't live very long. So they mate and they have babies. And then they die. And now the babies are born on the way to Canada, except they've never heard of Canada. They don't know where it is. And they don't know that they're going to Canada. And then they have babies. And then they die. And the grandchildren certainly don't know where they're going or that they're doing anything. And it's something like the fourth generation that ends up in Canada. And then the same process of generations repeats itself and they get back to Mexico. And this is baffling to scientists. Like, how does this happen? And when I heard this on the radio, my first reaction was, oh, they're talking about the Jewish people. Because, why? Because, you know, one of the greatest Hasidic masters, his name is Rebbe Nachman of Breslov, like huge, huge Rebbe. He said, wherever a Jew goes, every step a Jew takes, they're heading toward Israel. Even if they're walking in the opposite direction, they're still heading toward Israel. So can you imagine, we're kind of like the monarch butterflies, all of us. We're all on our way to Israel, whether we know it or not. And we're all going to end up there. Isn't that amazing? Right? Because that's the destiny of the Jewish people, is that we all kind of get back there. And we don't even know we're on our way. But we have this GPS inside of us, like the monarch butterfly has a GPS inside of us. And you know what? You want to hear something? Do you know about that GPS? It took you into this room tonight. It connected you to Eish Lit, right? Because you're probably, a lot of you probably were like, how did I get here again? And it's like that internal GPS. And now we're back to the baby in the womb. Because you talked about the subconscious, right? And that's what we're talking about. When we learn the Torah inside of our mother's womb, that homing device gets inside of us and it steers us to places that we're not even consciously aware of. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you something. I told you, let's see, who remembers? What's above the baby's head? Who is listening carefully? A candle. Ah, why are we talking about this now? So I heard in the name of the Satmar Rebbe, you know, one of the great Hasidic masters, he said, do you know what happens to that candle from when you learned the whole Torah inside of your mom? That candle ends up being your Hanukkah candle. And not only that, but that when you light that candle, what's happening is you are getting back in touch with the Torah that you learned that you forgot. Now I'm going to make it even deeper in a moment, okay? My Rebbe asks the following question. I think I think this is a great question, but he's going to get an even better answer in a moment. The question is like this. We have a tradition, a teaching, that everyone who is ever going to be Jewish, that means converts and also people who weren't born yet, all of their souls were at Mount Sinai. In other words, when God gave the Torah at Mount Sinai, it wasn't just the 2 million or so Jews who were alive who were there. Every soul that was ever going to be Jewish that wasn't even born yet was also at Mount Sinai. So in other words, all of us, everyone in this room, all of us got the Torah at Mount Sinai. So if that's the question, listen to the question. Why do you have to learn the Torah again in your mother's womb if you already got it at Mount Sinai? Isn't that a great question? Okay, so you know, you all gave such good answers before. Before I give you the answer that I heard, does anyone have a... Go ahead.
You didn't learn it, you just got it, but you didn't really take it in or understand it.
Okay, so you know, a lot of times, like, you have to learn something twice to learn it once. So that's why, like... So maybe to really get it. Okay, that's a great answer. Okay, let's hear it.
How about this? Ultimately, we have free choice.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And some say the purpose of our existence is to make this world a dwelling place for God.
Yeah.
If we know the entire Torah from birth, we're really not acting of our own will. Like, we would have no option to engage in these mitzvot.
Okay.
We would know that it's true.
Yeah.
And they would basically all be tzaddikim, and we would just be like angels. It'd be automatic for us. The fact that we unlearn it and engage in it in the way, I guess, like a Beinoni would, or someone who is unlearned, means we choose it, and we choose to connect to God.
Okay, I love it. So the new thought that I heard from you there is that when you get it in your mother's womb, it's not so much about learning it again, it's about forgetting what you've learned so that you can have free choice, which is, by the way, the whole purpose why God created this world. I mean, it's deeper than that, but that's a lot of it right there. Great answer, yeah. Okay, go ahead, Dawn. Yeah.
If you know there's like 10 people in front of you, you're like, you're there, you're like kind of, you're not really paying attention to like what you're about to say and what your script is. But when you know you're on deck, when you know you're next, you're like, okay, now I really gotta learn, I really gotta make a stick. So maybe like when you're in the womb, you're like, all right, I'm about to be on stage, whatever we're gonna call it.
Right. Wow, that's interesting. So it's sort of like you're on in five. It's sort of like you run for your script and like go over your lines again. That's cool. That's a nice visual. Anyone else? Anyone who hasn't given an answer before, don't be shy. Why? Does anyone remember the question? Okay. Can someone remind me of the question?
Why are we learning it for a third time?
Why are we learning it a second time? Okay. Yes. Thank you. Okay, you ready for this? If you already got the Torah at Mount Sinai, why are you learning it again in your mother's womb? So here's the answer I heard from my Rebbe, which is at Mount Sinai, each of us got the national mission. But in your mother's womb, you get your personal mission in this world, what you individually have to accomplish. Isn't that something? So that means, now let's kind of put that together with what we've been saying up until now. That means if the candle that you light on Hanukkah is restoring the Torah that you learned in your mother's womb, it also means that what's being restored to you is your personal mission in this world. And that's why I think Hanukkah is the most personal Jewish holiday. Because it's all about reconnecting and getting back in touch with what it is we're supposed to do, right? So now with that in mind, I think it's really interesting that this is also the boldest holiday. What do I mean by that? What do I mean by that? That it's the boldest holiday. It's not a trick question.
Like the loudest in the secular world, maybe?
Yeah, it is. You know, you've got like public lightings.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Things like that, that's a great example of it. But historically speaking, why would you say this is the boldest holiday? Just straight Hanukkah story information here. What?
Celebrating a victory over
Yeah, it's a military victory, the Maccabees. The Maccabees were these incredible like warriors. And by the way, the Medrash says that they were all skinny. They were like these scrawny guys. You know, they were like these scholarly, scrawny types that somehow just became like, you know, amazing, amazing warriors. So that's what I mean by the boldness. So what does it mean? And I'm gonna flesh this question out in a moment. What does it mean, like, we're recovering our personal mission in the world on Hanukkah, based on what we've been saying? But there's also this other interesting element, which is that you also have to be like a fighter. Like, it's not just being handed to you. Like, if you want to really know why am I in this world, you got to fight for that information a little bit. You got to be a little bit like a modern day Maccabee. So what does it mean to be a Maccabee in today's society? What do you think? Anyone who hasn't participated yet, what does that mean to you to be a Maccabee today? Go ahead.
I think it's to follow your truth and your values, you know, without letting anyone else tell you, like, how to live your life or, like, that you're not following what other people are doing. But if you have your values and your truth and the things that are important to you, that you're not going to sacrifice it just to please other people.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So is there anyone here who's had like a moment where it's just been easier not to publicly identify as a Jew, but you said, you know what, I'm gonna say I'm Jewish or whatever it is. Or I'm not going to, like, I don't know where people are holding, like, there was a period where I wasn't keeping kosher, But I decided I'm not going to eat pork, right? But I wasn't so kosher, but I said, okay, I'm drawing the line at pork, you know, or I'm drawing the line. Then a little bit later on, I said, well, I'm not eating pork because I don't eat pork anymore. Shrimp is fine. And then at a certain point, I said to myself, wait a second, shrimp is the same thing as pork. So slowly, and then I was like, I'm waiting between eating meat and milk, but I'm still going to have a fat burger, but I'm going to wait a few hours before I have an ice cream. And step by step by step by step, I got to the point where now I keep kosher, but it was like a, you know, step by step. So there were definitely times where I wasn't so religious and someone would offer me something that wasn't kosher and I'd have to say something or pretend just to avoid it. Like, is there anyone who's had a situation where they were proud of themselves for, like, saying I'm Jewish or something? Anyone want to share a moment like that? Does anyone have a moment like that?
I'll share it with you.
Okay, go ahead.
Since nobody's sharing. So yeah.
Yeah.
And it was our first idea to just like pretend we were German tourists. Like, oh, okay. Don't blend in. I'll just feel like German Christian tourists. But we went to this one little like baklava factory. And I was talking with the guy about, you know, just Israel and Palestine a little bit. And he's like, yeah, we don't really like the Jews. And I wanted to, it was important for me at that point because I had a rapport with him and I had some kind of connection with him. We were talking and we were familiar at that point, and I was like, you know what, I'm actually Jewish from America, and I wanted him to have a positive experience with someone that was Jewish, even potentially at the risk of these people, I don't know, spitting in my food or whatever, it's not worse for or I guess, it's that. This was in 2014, right after the kids were kidnapped also,
wow.
But it was very important for me to for these people, even though it felt potentially like a bad idea, to at least, you know, when they think about their experience with Jews,
they just have to meet one Jew that they like. They meet one Jew that they like, and then they you know, it kind of defuses their something because they can't make sense out of it. Well, if you're Jewish, you know. Anyone else? Anyone else have an example? Or yeah, go ahead. In the IDF or the U.S. Army?
Yeah, that's, you make the differentiation between the two, and then that's really where, you know, they obviously assume that you're Jewish, or, and that's when you're able to feel, you know, Abbas Am.
Were you in the IDF?
Yeah.
And so when you make a decision to share that information, that's a statement.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I totally hear that, yeah. So I want to tell you something. We learned it in the Torah just a few weeks ago. But it's, to me, it's a very powerful symbolic moment. So, you know, without going into too much information, I'm sure most of you are familiar with this. You have Yaakov and Esav, the twins inside the mother's womb. Jacob and Esau, I guess you'd say in English. And Yaakov gets the bracha, and Esav is like really unhappy about that, and Esav like pledges to kill Yaakov, and then Yaakov escapes with his life, and then like years later, something like 22 years later, like a long time later, Yaakov is finally coming home, and he gets told. Esav, he's thinking, Esav probably forgot about him at this moment. Esav is waiting for you with 400 soldiers, ostensibly to kill you and your family. And so, anyway, okay, it's a whole thing. That night, Yaakov wrestles with the angel, and you all know this story. But I'm building up to one particular moment where they finally meet each other. And Yaakov has sent all these presents to try to appease him. And Esav sees Yaakov and he kisses him. And in the Torah, it's very rare, in the Torah scroll, it's very unusual for there to be dots above a word. But there are dots above this word kiss. Even though the word kiss appears other places in the Torah, this kiss has dots above it, which is the rabbis, like I had a teacher one time who used a phrase that still comes to me. He says that the rabbis were desperate to communicate. They were desperate to communicate. So when they put like the little dots over there, they're saying, please understand what was the nature of Esav's kiss to Yaakov. So there's two very different interpretations. One interpretation is that it was a genuine, heartfelt kiss. That's one interpretation. The other interpretation is, because here's the actual line in the Torah, it says that Esav kissed Yaakov on the neck and he cried. So the second interpretation is that he went to bite his jugular vein to murder him, and that there was a miracle and Jacob's neck turned to marble, and that Esav's teeth broke. And because his teeth broke, he was in so much pain that he cried. Two very different interpretations. Would you agree? Would you agree? So my question to you is, and we're going to finish up, okay? That was my alarm that it's time for me to stop speaking. So, but my question to you is, like, what did I tell you? I told you that in your womb, right? Or in your mom's womb, that, small difference, I guess. Forgive me, ladies. In your mom's womb, all of us learned the Torah. And that you get reconnected with that Torah that you forgot. That's the candle. All of a sudden, you have a relationship with it. It's this personal holiday. And let me just add one more detail. There's something unique about Hanukkah. I'll give you the fancy Hebrew in a moment. We have this halacha, Jewish law, called Ish Ubeso, which means that each person has to light the menorah in their house. Is that personal? You know why it's so personal? Because it's all about you getting back in touch with your first house, if you will. You know? But you don't just get it. You have to be a bit of a Maccabee. You have to really fight for it a little bit. So you know what the interpretation that some people have is? What is that kiss of Esav? When he really meant it, not the version where he tried to bite his neck, where he meant it sincerely. You know, a lot of the exiles that the Jewish people have been through, they've just tried to murder us left and right. They've been so cruel and merciless to us, you know, tried to starve us by not giving us jobs. They've been so cruel to us. And then every once in a while, like Los Angeles 2022, or just America in general, every once in a while, there's a stop along the way in our exile where they kiss us. And it's a sincere, genuine kiss. And a lot of those are the most dangerous stops for us in the world. You know, millions of Jews, no gas chambers in America, millions of Jews have disappeared off the map. Because we don't have to fight for our Judaism anymore. We don't have to assert ourselves anymore. It's kind of like that kiss, but that's almost like a kiss of death in a way, in some ways. You know, where we get so comfortable that we just forget. And so Hanukkah is just a reminder to us that there's a light, there's a mission, just like those butterflies got to Canada, even though they didn't know they were going there, and then they got back home. And just like all of us are getting to Israel, right, that the Jewish people have a destiny. We really do have a destiny, and we're really all getting there, slowly, slowly, each in our own way, you know? And I just want to end with one story. I mentioned to you Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. He's the one who says that every step you take, you're heading toward Israel, even if you're heading in the opposite direction. So I want to tell you a story, which is How did he become a Rebbe? It's a short story, but it's a good one. It's a strong one. And I'll leave you with this, something to think about, okay? So back in the day in Russia, this is about, you know, early 1800s approximately, they didn't live very long, so they got married early. So they got married at like 13, you know? And so Rebbe Nachman was at his wedding hall, right? He's like 13 years old approximately. And he's just kind of standing there and, you know, the guests are starting to arrive. And as the guests are coming in, now you have to remember, this is like one of the holiest people who ever lived. He's looking them straight in the eye and he's saying, "Why are you here?" And they're like, you know, everyone gets freaked out by that question. You know, they're like, "Oh, you know, you haven't seen me since you were young, but, you know, I'm your cousin's uncle," or whatever it is. And another person comes up, he looks him in the eye, "Why are you here?" It's like, "Oh, actually, you know, I'm on your wife's side, so, you know, we haven't..." Everyone's giving like these like semi-panicked, you know, explanations, mm-hmm. answers. And then like another young person on fire comes in and he looks him in the eye, he says, "Why are you here?" And the person says back to him, "You know, I lie in bed every night asking myself the same question." Right? So he's the first person who got it. Like, why are you here? And he says, you know, there's a group of us who also ask ourselves that same question. And we meet in the forest and we learn together. And Rebbe Nachman, at some point, he went and he started learning with these people. And this is how Rebbe Nachman became a Rebbe. Those were his first students. So this is the big question, you know, why are we here? Okay, thank you.
Can we ask some questions? Or?
Oh yeah, should we do that? Yeah.
Does anyone want to ask some questions, maybe about your career or so?
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Oh yeah. Oh no. Yeah, and by the way, I don't want to hold anyone hostage. If anyone wants to leave, you know, the talk's over. So. But I'm happy to answer any questions and talk more about the Hollywood stuff, you know, if you like. Happy to tell you some Simpson stories or whatever, if you like. Yeah, yeah. You want to hear a Simpson story?
Yes.
So... Okay, so I was on the Simpsons the fifth and sixth seasons, and I thought I was catching the end of the run of the show, right? I think they're up to like season 35 or something like that, maybe more. I don't know, something insane. So, I'm shocked that, you know, at the longevity. By the way, if anyone wants to ask me, how do they predict all that stuff? I have no idea. So don't even bother. You won't get a good answer from me. So, but I was keeping Shabbos at that point in my life. I had been keeping Shabbos for a few years. And, you know, there were about 12 writers. About half of them were from Harvard, by the way. And we spent maybe 20 minutes. Like, you've got a group of like 10, 12 people. We spent at least 20 minutes per line of the episode. I mean, the amount of effort and the striving for the highest quality for every single line of that show was extraordinary. In fact, this was back in the days of VCRs, okay? Like, there would be scenes where there would be a sign on the wall, like, behind the characters that you could only see if you videotaped it and freeze-framed it. We'd spend 20 minutes on what the sign said. A whole room of people. Right? So, I mean, it was really something. The dedication to quality was amazing. Anyway, a lot of these people were extremely cynical. I mean, they were nice people, but they were not spiritual for the most part, and very, very cynical. But that was where their razor sharpness came in, because, you know, they were able to apply their cynicism in a very good way. In that they were able to look at all sorts of hypocrisy in society and just skewer it, you know what I mean? Just like ridicule it. But, you know, but that came from this very cynical kind of point of view usually. So in other words, why am I telling you this? Because my seat was all the way over here, and it was a big room, and there was one door, which was all the way on the other side of the room, and it was a very long room, kind of like from here to the door, almost. And I'd have to leave Friday afternoon, always in the middle of a session, for Shabbos. And it wasn't one of those places where you go, good Shabbos, good Shabbos, good Shabbos. Not that, this was not that, okay, you understand? So what I would do is, I would just like stand up and I would walk out as though I were going to the bathroom, but I wouldn't come back, you understand? Now, a year after I left the show, I was like, went to some Simpsons event, and someone says to me, oh yeah, you know, we had a nickname for you. And I was like, I never knew that. I was like, really? What was that? And they said, oh yeah, we'd call you the Invisible Jew. I said, really? Yeah. Because every Friday you would disappear and no one would see you leave. And we'd always say, next week we're going to look. And then always next week, it's like, he's gone again. How did that happen? So that's a... That's a Simpsons story. So, yeah, go ahead.
I have a question. Sure. What was like the process of writing like a TV show like this? Would they give you some sort of a synopsis in the beginning and then all of you guys would like brainstorm and then would you...
be two stories, so there would be an A story and a B story. And then we'd, as a room, we would flesh out how the story would go, and people would also include a lot of jokes, and people were taking notes and things like that. And then they'd select one writer to go off and assemble that in the form of a script, and then they would bring it back to the room, and then the whole room would sort of like rewrite it together. And sometimes nothing would be left from that original script, and other times chunks of it would remain. But it was largely a group effort for the most part.
How long did it take to get...
Okay, great question. Great question. So from the time that you began with the idea to the finished product was usually 9 months.
Wow.
9 months, like a child, like a baby.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. One episode. And you'd be working on about 5 episodes at a time. You know, because they'd all be in different stages. Yeah, different stages. Like this one would be at the first draft rewrite level. This one would be like animation has already come in, so you're working on that.
Just rolling.
Yeah, you had, like they call it a waterfall production chart. I don't know if you've ever seen a television production chart, but every show is overlapping over the others, and so you're working on simultaneous episodes at different stages of production, all in the same day.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was wondering what qualities you think a lot of successful people in Hollywood have in common.
Madness.
Smart.
Madness and a lot of mazel, because it's really, you know, it's really weird, because Hollywood is really weird. Like, for instance, let's say I want to be an accountant, right? So maybe I'll major in accounting. And then maybe I've got good grades. And then there's certain accounting firms, and they've got hiring seasons. And then I'll apply to the accounting firm. And they'll say, oh, you have a degree in accounting. You got good grades in accounting. You seem to be a reasonable person. You have a job in accounting. There is no orderly way to get a job in Hollywood. It's just like every single person who gets into Hollywood has their own unique story. There is no entry door into Hollywood. There is no entry door. And even if you get a degree from like USC Film School, which is like one of the hardest programs in the country to get into, there's still no way, the formal way to get in. So it's a very, that's why I say mazel. Because it's a very strange industry in that way. And then once you're in, it's also very strange because you can be doing good work, but then it's sort of like, well, that was your last one. Like they say, you're only as good as your last show. So you kind of have to, not entirely, like at a certain point you can kind of make a reputation for yourself, but you kind of have to keep on starting over again and over again. And shows also have short lifespans. Like if you're at like a prestigious law firm, that's not going out of business in 3 years, but a show is going out of business in 3 years. And then you have to start again and find a different job. So it's a very peculiar industry. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. You're next.
Great speech. Obviously, everyone, we all heard the news, like, you know, these new, like, anti-Semitic tropes about Jews controlling Hollywood and things like that. And, you know, even if I went to a Hanukkah event last night at City Walk, major event, 1,000-plus people, and they made an announcement, like, no flags are allowed. Like, you know, clearly as a signal that we shouldn't, like, you know, show the Israeli flag. So it's, like, it's becoming more mainstream to be, if not, like, you know, explicitly anti-Semitic. Like, at least, like, shunning away from Israel. And I know it's a complicated subject. Like, at least your experience in Hollywood, like, how do you, what's your take on anti-Semitism in Hollywood? And maybe even, like, broader, like, is this a blip or is this something that is going to be, you know, a larger societal
right. issue? I honestly don't know. I don't know myself. I'll just tell you a couple reactions, but, you know, everyone can have their own answer to this question. When I first started out, I really interacted with a lot of Jews in Hollywood. I'm just talking about in the span of my own personal career. Now, there's such a smaller number of Jews in Hollywood today, really, like significantly smaller on writing staffs, in the executive ranks. Lots of places, no Jews at all. So, I've seen that change just in my years out here. Historically speaking, Hollywood was founded by Jews. It really was. And there's a fantastic book called An Empire of Their Own, which I recommend. It's a wonderful book, great history. But slowly, you really don't see that many Jews out here. And part of that is because of, you know, the need for diversity and inclusion and everything like that's a big reason why you don't see it. And then just other societal factors, I guess. In terms of is Hollywood anti-Semitic, I would phrase it differently. Hollywood is pro-money. And if you can make a lot of money from a movie about dancing Hasidim, they will make 10 of them. They don't care. They just want to make money. And if you can make a lot of money by showing how Orthodox people are insane, you know, like reality shows that, oh, they're insane, actually, and those are popular, they'll make 10 of those. But not because they're anti-Semitic. It's because whatever is selling, that's what Hollywood makes. They just want to make money.
You think it's just money? You don't think there's like a underlying like political incentive?
Me personally, I don't. I personally don't. No, especially in the big studios and things like that, their stock doesn't go up if they make more anti-Semitic films. Their stock goes up if they make films that people want to see, and so that's what they're all chasing after. Now, if anti-Semitism sells, then that's not great for us because then they really want to do that, but not because they're anti-Semitic, just because they want to make money. Yeah, and in terms of whether it's a blip or not, well, you know, you can look at it this way, which is a little bit darker, what I'm about to say, which is that kind of the rule of history has been anti-Semitism. And so you could say that things are just back to normal. You know, you could look at it that way, you know. So I'm just giving you another perspective. I don't know. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. You were next. I'm sorry. I want to keep my word. You're next.
Mine was a very light question. I was just curious who decided what Bart Simpson would write on the chalkboard in the intro.
Oh, yeah.
I love
So periodically, I had one of those. So periodically, they would say, okay, they would call those the chalkboard things. So periodically, they'd say, everyone write up like 10 chalkboard things and hand them in. And then they would select them, and then that would be, you know, the next batch. Yeah.
Did any of them ever get, like, rolled over to the next episode? Or, I don't know.
Or, well, I think it's a fresh one. There's a fresh one every single episode. Yeah.
I know this one.
Yeah, and a new couch gag every episode. They close the couch couch gags. Yeah, yeah. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so just because you were talking about it right now, my family actually recorded on VCR every single episode of The Simpsons until they came out in DVDs, and you pause it and look at the sign.
Yes.
Like that, so just so you know,
yes.
Somebody who was like...
oh, no. We knew. We knew.
But,
yeah.
Yes, okay, good, I'm glad. But,
yeah.
I was going to ask you about your Baal Teshuvah, like, journey.
Yes.
That's what you call it.
Yeah.
Was there something that? I know you did it in increments of the no pork.
And yeah.
But was there something like major or something?
Okay, so great question. And I'll try to summarize it. By the way, I've got a whole speech on that on YouTube.
Okay.
That's like a really fun speech, but I'll give you just a couple of moments because that's like an hour long kind of thing. But I'll just give you a few answers. So I was really fortunate. Like, I set, like, all these high goals for myself, and I was, you know, more or less able to accomplish them. And as I was accomplishing them, I was really enjoying them. Like, I was really having a good time, you know? But I was like, okay, well, now that I got that thing that I wanted, like, that was fun. I liked it. But it's not the be-all and end-all. And then I set another goal and I get that. And it's sort of like, well, that was like super cool. But it's not like the be-all and end-all. And then at a certain point, I felt like, wow, there's got to be more to life than this. And so there was a lot of things going on inside of me. One of them, in terms of wanting to keep Shabbos, because that was like the big turning point for me at 24, as I said, was I wanted to say thank you back to God. And I felt like that was the best way. Just everyone has their own personal way of doing it. That was the best way for me to do it, keeping Shabbos. And also, I'll tell you like a really cool teaching, okay? And then I'll tell you how to find the YouTube thing if you want to get the full answer. I heard this teaching, and I thought that it was in the name of of this great Hasidic master from about 100 years ago, okay? And then later I found out that it was actually said by a biker in drug rehab who had, like, tattoos up and down his arms, right? I think that this is actually an even better teaching, actually knowing that it comes from that source, okay? Which is the following, that all of us, every single one of us, is created with a God-shaped hole inside of us. So we sense, all of us sense that there's something missing in our life. And people like react to it differently. Like, so we try to fill that hole. And like some of us use, like some of us it's food. Others it's shopping. Other of us it's money. Or career. Other of us, it's sex. Other of us, it's drugs. You know, just getting high, whatever it is. Like just different ways to plug that hole that we feel inside of us. But if you've ever done a jigsaw puzzle, right? Like, you know, let's say you've got this finished patch over here, and there's like one piece missing. Like, if you put the wrong piece in, you can like bang on it, but it's not going in. It's got to be the right piece. So if each one of us is created with this God-shaped hole inside of us, the only thing that actually fills that hole is God, right? Like I thought of it this way. You know what a USB port is, right? So that's like that hole, right? So God like creates us with this USB port so that we can connect to him, right? Like that's there for a reason, so that we have this longing, and then we channel that longing to make that connection. I do a weekly podcast, by the way. It's called Spiritual Tools for an Outrageous World. So it's every week, and you can go online. There's a lot of episodes, and you know, talk about deep stuff and funny stuff, all sorts of things, and Why did I bring that up?
The USB.
The USB port, yeah.
It was an advertisement.
Did you just do one on that?
An advertisement, yeah. Shameless plug. Shameless plug. Yeah, I don't remember. It will come back to me. But yeah, I know why I wrote it up. Because at the beginning, I have sort of like this pre-taped introduction.
Okay.
Like, you know, sort of like, you know, welcome to my podcast. You know? And I call these talks couples therapy between us and God. And I really think that like a lot of life is like couples therapy between you and God. You know? Like how, okay, now that I, like okay, I'll give you another example. One of my biggest teachers, he okay, so for all of you movie fans and rom-com fans, okay? So here's the classic rom-com structure, romantic comedy. You've got three acts. Okay, it goes like this. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. That is your basic narrative structure, okay? So what he would say is like a lot of these rom-coms end with a wedding. And then the movie's over. And he said, wait, I want to know what that, now I'm interested. How do they live with each other? Like now that they have each other, how do they live with each other? And so the name of my website, the web address is livingwithgod.org. Because it's sort of like, now we have God and God has us, now what? You know, like that's our whole lives. That's our 70 or 80 years in this world or whatever it is. Now what? You know, so yeah. Shall we stop there? Go ahead.
I just have a quick Simpsons question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Like religion.
Yeah.
Simpsons, I don't know if you ever pushed for that. You know, like
yeah.
Krusty, his dad is Jewish.
Yeah.
Like Christianity is like a big theme also.
Yeah.
Very cynical, but I guess kind of how did you play a role in that?
Yeah, I never did any kind of religious stuff on that. Like, yeah. Yeah. So I didn't really, so I'm sorry. I'm sorry if that's disappointing.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Oh, we have one more there?
Yeah.
One more? Okay, we'll make that the last one. Yeah. I would say Homer, because, yeah.
What about outside the family?
Outside the family? Flanders was great. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, Mo was fun. I'll say Milhouse. I'll say Milhouse. Yeah. Okay, and let me give you guys all an invitation. The rabbi mentioned that I'm involved with the Happy Minion. I see some faces here that I recognize from the Happy Minion. Every Friday night, especially this time of year, it's especially good. A lot of singing, a lot of dancing. We have l'chaims after davening. If you want to do a l'chaim before davening, bring your own bottle. But it's really like the energy is really exceptional. And I think that everyone here just kind of getting your vibe would really enjoy it. So I recommend it. And then I give a talk Shabbos morning from 8:30 to 9 in the morning. And then we have the davening and then we have a kiddush. And then we have a really nice third meal starting at 4 p.m. And just like singing and kind of like a chance to like, that's the highest point of Shabbos. Chance to connect and kind of share with each other and stuff like that. And then if you want to check out the podcast, I just put something up about Hanukkah, about that candle, but you've already heard it. But it's also only 2 minutes, so if you want to review it, you can check it out. And other than that, it's really wonderful to meet you, and I want to thank you so much for the invitation. Yeah.